Hi, I'm Taylor Smurl.
And I'm Liz June.
And this is Neat. Weekly Boozecast.
It's a history lesson with a twist.
Ooh.
And did you make the ooh part of our shtick?
Because I feel think like so. You've I been do it a doing lot. That. I do it a lot.
Yeah. Well, hey, hey there, ho there, gobble gobble. It's
yeah. You might need a twist or two right now because you might be home with your family because it's Thanksgiving.
If you are at home, you need a place to escape. We're here for you. Just go into the spare bedroom. If there's a cat in the house, bring them in there and just put on your headphones and listen to the sweet, sweet, soothing sounds of us talking about booze.
Yes.
Yeah. So we're going to talk some Thanksgiving talk.
One thing that, is always hard for me as the renegade weird vegan in the family is that maybe for Thanksgiving, you're expected to bring a dish, but you know what? Nobody wants my weird vegetables. Nobody wants my nut cheeses.
Nobody wants your nut cheese.
Nope. And that's fine. And or maybe you're weird vegan like me. Maybe you just don't like to cook. But I want to give you an option of something to bring if that's where you're at. Maybe don't worry about cooking anything. Don't bring a dish. Maybe bring a punch.
Hey, bring a punch. Punch it out.
Yeah.
Get them punches.
You don't want to bring punches to your family gathering. I mean, no. Sometimes you do. I've been there. But maybe just want a punch
to.
Instead.
Yeah, maybe you want to bring punches, but instead just bring one punch in liquid form.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, and I know like today the term punch can mean a lot of things. Sometimes it means high fructose corn syrup and fake colors and juice boxes. Exactly. But in its origin, it was a delicious and boozy shareable beverage.
Oh, have we talked about this a little bit on the...
We talked about punch when we talked about the British Navy. And that's important because I'm not going to say it's a British invention, but the British have a hand in the popularization of punch. Oh. When we talk about punch, there's kind of, maybe you've heard it, maybe you haven't, there's like this essential rhyme that's spoken about it.
Do tell.
That is one of sour, two of sweet, three of strong, four of weak. Now that specific idea comes from one of the first recorded punch recipes, which is from Barbados. It's a rum punch, and that core balance is behind much of the history and actually the mystery of its namesake. Because like so many things in booze history, there's some confusion to this. The earliest known recorded mentions of punch come from the 17th century, and it is from that British East India Trading Company that we talked about on our IPA episode, which was just last week.
Hey, reference. Yeah.
If you didn't listen last week, that's okay. I mean, judged, but that's okay. They were a London-based company of merchant traders, which were eventual colonizers that traveled all around the Indian Ocean beginning in the 1600s. Now, I will say that I thought I knew the etymology of the word. There's like a really cute story that's told about it, and that's that the word punch comes from a Hindi word meaning five. It's punk, which is...
Oh, yeah. I remember you telling me about that.
I thought that was true forever, and that refers to like five essential ingredients. And in this sense, it's alcohol, lemon, water, sugar, and tea or spice. But there's a really important cocktail historian by the name of David Wondrich who wrote a book called Punch. And he kind of throws this theory under the bus.
Really?
Yeah. Because, for logical reasons. Now, the reason the first theory related to the Indian origin makes sense is because it was proliferated by the East India Trading Company. And there was already kind of a custom in India of mixing like the spirits. It was a rack that they were usually mixing, but that was already a thing that they did. Right. So there is a reason you might think that.
Also because there's five ingredients. So there's five fingers put together makes a punch.
I wish, you know what, that's never been something that's like been like, that line hasn't been drawn. You're the first person to maybe think
I am I'm an innovator.
I want that to be true.
All right.
But like, you know, there is background for why this might have been the story. But Wondridge points out in his book that punch was already a term for something like short and stout, and it was used to describe smaller barrels that would be used for transporting liquor, okay. But were often used as the serving vessels for punch.
Oh.
So, and another true point is that if you remember that first rhyme that I quoted you, that had four ingredients.
Oh.
So that a punch can be five ingredients, it can be six ingredients, it can be four ingredients, it can be eight ingredients. And this is all like classic punch recipes from this time. So it starts to fall apart when you think about, well, punch was something that we already used. There was even a type of barrel, like a small barrel that we described as a punch-in barrel. It was a small barrel. Yeah, so maybe one theory is true, maybe the other one's true, maybe both, maybe neither. It's hard to say with early alcohol history, but in any case.
Everyone's drunk.
Actually,
everyone's got too much punch.
I found a quote from Wondrich. It's like, who knows? They were all like, people that couldn't read. It's like, okay.
Yeah, fair.
Oh, right. Okay.
But,
you know, but in any case, it's definitely proliferated by the British East India Trading Company in the early 1600s. That's when you start seeing punch being mentioned in writing. The first actual case we get is in 1632. It's basically just somebody in the company writes to somebody else who mentions punch in a letter, like, don't drink too much of it.
Don't drink too much punch. Take it easy on the punch.
And then there's like a German factory worker in India that notices his workers making something that was a combination of like liquor and citrus and sugar and like rose water. And so the idea of punch is already out there. Like a lot of these things, probably the idea was out there. Probably people in India were already making punch. The British saw it, they liked it, and they took that idea and made it big.
They stole it.
I think that's probably the case, because there's evidence that they were already mixing things. Like, so in any case, like, a lot of theories point to that, like, sailors running low on beer. Some of them will say the beer's spoiled. As we've learned, that's probably not the case. The beer probably didn't spoil. But they would just drink too much stuff. So they'd have to make the voyage back, and they'd be like, well, okay, the only, like, local liquor is this, like, kind of, like, rum at the time was kind of rough stuff, you know? At the time was rough stuff.
Right, because we didn't know how to make it good, yeah. So we just thought it was, like, just random shit and spices.
Yeah, it was definitely not the most, like, smooth, quaffable beverage at the time.
Mm-mm.
So they would kind of, like, approximate, like, well, we know we like beer and wine. How do we make this stuff kind of like that? They'd dilute it, they'd add citrus, they'd add sugar. So these sailors in the East India Company were probably making the first punch as just a way to make an easily consumable version of the spirits they were encountering around the Indian Ocean. Now, as just a happy byproduct of this that they had no plans for, the punch helped keep scurvy away, which obviously is,
you don't important. Want that scurvy.
Yeah. But once they got back to, once it started making its way back to mainland, like to London, it became very fashionable. People that like paid for these ships, backed the shipping companies, and like, you know, like the well-to-do would meet the ships when they'd come back into the deck, and they'd drink some of the punch they had with them.
And
there's this funny, like, to me there's a funny separation between the kind of people that are drinking punch at this time, because you have the aristocracy who start to like take the idea of punch and make it a popular thing, because they can afford spices, they can afford lemons, which I know that sounds weird, but at the time, like, a lemon was like a prized object,
right. Like the whole, oh my god, that you brought this up, but the episode of Harlots when she opens the gift. The little like chest, and it's a pineapple.
Well, and that's like these were readily available, you know, in India, but like, it wasn't. When you get back to like England, it's like, oh, we need lemons and nutmeg for this. Only fancy people can afford that, right. You know. But then you also had sailors. So you had sailors drinking it. You had a working class type of people that were introducing it and were consuming it en masse. And then the only kind of people that were consuming it were the aristocracy. So it's a weird cultural divide here that these are the people you had consuming punch around this time.
I always just think of the part in Pride and Prejudice when she says, oh, tell the servants they shall have a bowl of punch.
Like, it's like a special occasion. We're going to have some punch.
I mean, it became a big deal, especially, like, a lot of things culturally changed around this time. Like, probably the punches that were first being made in Europe, in England, were based in, like, brandy and fortified wines. But then in, like, the late 1600s, like, 1655 specifically, like, rum becomes widely available. Mm. Rum punches catch on. Rum is a bigger trade. Like, the sugar trade kicks up. And from here, like, the punch bowl becomes a really important symbol of wealth.
Oh.
Like, owning a punch bowl. And people, like, melt down, like, precious metals to make a beautiful punch bowl.
Oh, my God.
They would, like, there was status related to the size of your punch bowl.
So that has to be, like, that has to have to do with, like, these, like, beautiful crystal punch bowls mm-hmm. we even have today. Like, that was a tradition.
Yeah. Because
it was a symbol.
Oh, it's like, that's like, well, that's a nice punch bowl. Mine is bigger than yours. Mine can fit two whole kids. Like, like that was, you know, and this wasn't even just like this. At this point in time, we've got the American colonies and that it was carried over to there, too. Like, the punch bowl became a big symbol of wealth in the colonies. Other things kind of compounded this. For one, these new alcohols being presented to the market, they weren't slapped with tax codes quite yet, so it was a lot cheaper to sell them.
Mm.
And, you know, at this point, Great Britain had a bad habit of picking wars with Spain and France. And so things like cognac and brandy were a lot harder to get a hold of. But hey, rum was everywhere.
There. So, there you go.
Yeah. And actually, not only did sailors and the aristocracy love punch, but so did revolutionaries.
Oh, are we in America now?
We're in America now, where supposedly, after the signing of the Declaration of Independence, the founding fathers drank 76 bowls of punch to commemorate the event.
Well, how many of them were there at the time? Let's think about this. How many colonies was it?
I mean,
I feel like, you know, I'm not a historian. There's 13 original.
I guess it's not that much punch per person. It's still a lot of punch.
I mean, it's kind of like a, wait, how? What was the number?
76 bowls of punch.
So it's like roughly like a third. If there's a, I mean, if there's 100 people in the room, then that's like roughly a bowl of punch to one person.
They were boozy times.
Yeah, you know.
There was one source that was like, there's a particular punch that was made to basically serve like an entire colony. Like, they just use like 30 barrels of this. Like, the measurements are so massive, like 20 loaves of sugar.
And it's loaves?
Like, loaves. I didn't know sugar came in loaves.
I didn't really know that either.
But it's just like,
you
just to make
like a sugar loaf?
I guess it makes sense. I could see that, you know. But just like, just such a large quantity. It was, because it was a communal beverage. It was, you know, the way that people drank it was either celebratory for like a communal experience or on a ship where everybody's drinking the same thing. We're making it in mass. Like, you know, this was the way it was consumed. You wouldn't just make punch at home for yourself
or
your
family.
No, you
wouldn't just make one for you.
No.
That's rude. You got to make it for everybody. Everybody has to have punch. It's a party.
Well, and unfortunately, this attitude starts to change. Unfortunately, I don't know. You know, just given the facts, no judgment applied. But
right.
In like, especially like kicked up around like the Victorian age, you start to see a lot of like non-alcoholic recipes for punch. For ladies and children is the way it's sold.
Oh,
yes.
Okay. This is where we got Hawaiian punch.
Yeah. This is kind of exacerbated by Queen Elizabeth, who wasn't a fan of strong drink. Like non-alcoholic fruit juice or sorbet and like sherbet. Like the things we think of now as like the shitty punches. This is when they start getting introduced to the idea of punch.
Right.
And just like those were fashionable. Less drinking in general becomes fashionable. And also compounding this is the invention of readily available ice in increasing quantities.
Ah.
Yeah. Which makes like being able to have a single serve cocktail a lot more available. And, you know, you move up from here in through like the 19th and 20th century where you just have people changing, like drinking kind of changes throughout Europe and America from something that you do only in like a social situation and something that you go to a bar and do singularly.
Mm.
So there's less of an emphasis on everybody drinking the same thing and more just like, I want to go to a bar and get my own drink.
That seems like it's not fair to the ladies of this time because they can't go to the bar.
Well, I mean, when you're moving into the 19 and 20th
right, well, then, century, then yeah. they can.
I mean, but that's like, part of the thing that drives it. It starts like drinking moves into bars. It's less for social engagements and for the upper class, and it's more for the everyman, and mm-hmm. the everyman is not having a party every time they want to drink.
You're right about that. I mean, I know if I could have a party every time I wanted to drink, I would, but it's just not practical.
No, and sometimes you don't go to a bar and order a punch.
No,
yeah. Sit there just drinking from the bowl, that'd be weird. You can't do that. Weird.
You just gotta get enough for yourself.
Punch eventually did make its comeback. We've seen this in our lifetime. Outside of whatever the hell that 7-Up and Sherbert thing we all had to drink in elementary school, around the mid-90s, with all the other cocktails that came back into fashion, punch came along with it. So now at most, like, bars that pride themselves on, like, having, you know, a pre-prohibition style menu or kind of going back to old school cocktailing styles, you'll see some punches on the menu.
Mm. I want to go back to the 7-Up and Sherbert thing. What is that, a real thing?
Wait,
is
have that you never something had that? That
you had? No, I never had
what?
That.
What? Oh, okay, that's a weird thing for you.
I had high C. That was my jam.
No, like when you had a party in elementary school, there was a big bowl and it was full of pineapple juice, 7-Up, and Sherbert.
Maybe it's a West Virginia thing.
I don't think it's a West Virginia thing. You all let us know if this is a thing that is relegated to just my
I don't know if it's a state thing or if it's a county thing or if it's just like something, I don't know. Well, yeah, tell us about it. I don't know. I grew up in Ohio. We had Hawaiian punch and a high C. I've never heard of that.
Well, it wasn't, and like something you'd buy in a
right, but it's you make it.
Yeah, that was the punch that you made for a party.
That makes sense, but we never did that. I don't remember that.
I think it's a thing.
Well, I'll ask my mom, I guess.
In any case.
If I ever drank that.
I definitely did. But in the terms of a party, and definitely for a Thanksgiving gathering, it's great because it's got a lot of negotiable like flavors in it. Like you can change the base spirit. You can change the teas. You can pick your citrus. You can pick your sweeteners. It's more of just one of those formulas you can follow and alter it wildly to make something fun and new. And depending on your family, it's an easy, traditional way to bring people together, or, you know, sneak in alcohol where you won't readily taste it. I don't know your
right.
fam.
I mean, the adult punches I have partaken in have been extremely sneaky about their alcohol content. So that is a good way to loosen everybody up if that's your goal. And, you know, maybe put them to bed early so that you can stay up and feel the way that you feel. I don't know. Or maybe everybody goes to bed early.
Yeah. Or just make some punch for you and that cat that you're hiding in a room with.
Yeah.
That's okay. That's fine.
I love my family. I'm not.
I know. No. I mean, same. But, you know.
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, if you want to kick things up a notch, you know, don't just go for that punch. You could just bring a bottle of Wild Turkey.
Oh, so instead of, like, turkey, Wild Turkey.
Just bring a Wild Turkey, okay. Especially, like, that's another vegan solution.
That's a vegan option. Yes, that's vegan turkey is Wild Turkey.
Yeah.
Now you know.
Wild Turkey liquor, Wild Turkey whiskey,
yes,
to be specific. So the story of Wild Turkey, gobble gobble.
You say that every time.
I don't know if can you do a convincing turkey impression?
I'm a turkey.
do the gobble.
Well, you okay? That's good too.
The gobble. I thought mine was fine. You say gobble gobble really fast and high, and you do like a Julia Child or like Mrs. Doubtfire voice, but you say gobble gobble really fast.
I'm a turkey.
That was good.
Okay, great.
Good job.
It's good.
You did it.
Wonderful.
So the story of Wild Turkey started in the mid-1800s when James Rippey and his brother John came to America from Tyrone, Ireland, and eventually settled in Lawrenceburg, Kentucky. And James started engaging in the local trade. They began with like dry goods and then wholesale liquor. And then in 1869, he built a distillery. And sometime during their settlement, they decided to name, they settled like below this big, this like gigantic limestone deposit. And like, they're like, this is Tyrone now. Or this is Tyrone. Because they came from Tyrone, and okay. Then they decided to rename the place that they settled Tyrone.
That makes sense.
Yeah, it makes it feel a little bit more like home, although I'm sure the landscape was slightly different. that's where his son, James's son, Thomas B. Rippey, built the Old Hickory Distillery in 1891. So it becomes a family business. Thomas dies in 1902, and then wham, bam, prohibition happens.
No. What happens with that? I bet something bad.
You know, they like it was pretty hard to get the license to keep making whiskey. Like, you would have to get a medicinal license. Right. So they're like a small family business, so they didn't get that. So they kind of had to like chill and stop and make do during prohibition. They had to figure shit out, but they did manage to survive prohibition and repair the distillery so they can start producing bourbon again after it's lifted.
Nice.
They sold the bourbon they produced to wholesalers who bottled it under their own brands. And one of those wholesalers was Austin Nichols. Okay. So here's a really cute story.
Oh, we got a whiskey meet cute.
Yeah, I mean, okay, so in 1940, we're skipping ahead a little bit, an Austin Nichols executive named Thomas McCarthy took some warehouse samples with him on a wild turkey hunting trip, and his friends loved it so much that they started asking him all the time for that wild turkey bourbon. So by 1942, Austin Nichols decided, hey, I'm gonna make that a name, make it a brand. They started bottling under the name Wild Turkey.
So it was just the same booze, but bottled under a name that he thought was more special to him.
Yeah. So in 1949, the Rippey family, they've like kept it in the family all this time, but they got bought out by Robert and Alvin Gold, which continued to sell to Austin Nichols, who at the time was still a non-distiller producer. So that means they do not own a distillery.
So this is private labeling just before we had that idea of it.
Yeah, so Austin Nichols bottled whiskey.
All right,
so,
well, that still goes on today. I mean, yeah. You know, we're talking about the whole, like, the Templeton Rye thing.
Right,
it's just that.
Exactly.
It's private labeling a mass-produced liquor.
Mm-hmm.
It's just funny that in this time, we didn't have that language for it. So it's like, oh, this is just the cool history.
That's
like,
exactly...
Oh, our history is private labeling.
Right, that's exactly what it is. So Austin Nichols was a non-distiller producer, but they transitioned in 1971 when they bought the distillery from Robert and Alvin Gold. That was still... It was kind of like a... It was a Rippey-Gold collaboration at the time. So they just bought it out and they changed the name of the distillery to Wild Turkey Distillery. It changed hands again in 1980 when Pernod Ricard bought the brand and the distillery. So they own not only the Wild Turkey Distillery, the actual facility, but they own the brand.
Right.
And, you know, that's 1980. That's not too far back in time, but... A little bit more trivia before I get to what I really want to talk about. There was a giant fire in May 2009. A fire destroyed a 7-story aging warehouse in Anderson County, Kentucky, along with more than 17,000 wooden barrels of whiskey.
Oh, no. That sounds like a big old fire.
Yeah, it was bad. So burning whiskey flowed from the warehouse and it set the nearby woods on fire. And it caused limestone deposits to explode.
Oh, wow.
And also about 20% of the whiskey got into the Kentucky River. And that caused a shutdown of the water treatment plant and a water shortage and the closing of schools and businesses. And it killed an estimated 228,000 fish in a 66-mile stretch, and the company had to pay $256,000 to the Kentucky Department of Fish and Wildlife in an effort to restore the population. So sad, dead fish. So sad.
Did the fish die because the alcohol?
It's because something about like the alcohol oxidation, like it's basically like, have you seen this? There's this viral video of this little boy catfishing and pouring a bottle of Coke and Mentos into a hole. So it basically like it makes it so that like the alcohol, because when it is in the water, it kind of sucks the oxygen out of the water. It basically makes the fish suffocate. Like it's like they're drowning.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So yeah, it's weird and sad. But you know, they had to rebuild that fish population. But then after that, like later that year, the Campari Group acquired the distillery and the Wild Turkey brand, and that's who currently has it today. Now, here's what I actually really, really want to talk about.
All right.
I want to talk about Wild Turkey Funk.
Is that like a musical group?
No. It's not a musical group. It's not the Chicken Dance Squared. It's like this whole other thing. So deep in the online whiskey collection forums, there's a type of Wild Turkey bottles that is sometimes available for purchase known as Dusties.
So they're old.
Yeah. Right. And for some bourbon nerds, these vintage bourbons from the early 1970s to 1989, approximately, there's a little bit of leeway in there, have exactly the flavors they've been looking for.
Okay.
Yeah. So this is like an internet thing. The fandom likely began on Reddit and across vintage liquor blogs, probably most perpetuated by David Jennings, who is a Wild Turkey enthusiast who blogs under the name Rare Bird. And after tasting various samples of Wild Turkey 101, with vintages as early as the 1970s, he created this Venn diagram to classify differences in flavors from the Dusties to the modern.
All right.
And according to Jennings, although most Wild Turkey exhibits the classic flavor notes, which is rich vanilla, honey maple, brown sugar, musty oak, the Dusties also have notes of floral perfume, sweet herbs and spice, fragrant tobacco, and leather. So if you want to drink something that tastes leathery.
I like leather in a drink. I like that flavor note.
All right, cool. I don't know how I would pick that up, but I'm interested in it. It's a weird
roasty tannin thing.
Okay. Does it taste funky?
It is funky.
All right, there we go. So, and the modern style, like the modern Wild Turkey you get has more like nutty toffee or caramel notes.
All right.
And others have described the Dusties as having like an oily mouthfeel, and they describe the taste ranging from like that of port wine to having a damp mustiness or like a flavor of blue cheese.
That's weird because it seems like something that would go off would produce those flavors.
Right, yeah. I mean, well, yeah. but, you know, regardless, what these Dusties have is that Wild Turkey funk.
Okay.
That's what we use to describe this whole classification of flavor. So where does the funk come from? Well, there are some theories.
Okay.
Some bourbon historians believe it could be a number of factors like the copper stills that they used in the 70s and 80s, the lack of water treatment, barrel size, even storage can be a factor. But Jennings thinks that it's due to a specific event in 1989, which was the lowering of urethane levels, which was something that happened by law. They had, like, legally, they had to make sure that that was lower. And urethane is a crystalline compound formed naturally in fermentation, and it can sometimes produce a bitter flavor. But also, in large quantities, it can be cancer-causing.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and it's found in particularly high levels in older bourbon. But apparently it's, like, super taboo to talk about that in the alcohol industry because, like, it's something that's, like, just a byproduct of fermentation. Like, it's in
most everything. And there has been, obviously, there's been legislation so that you have to control the level of urethane in the alcohol.
So they say that's what's present in these bottles, possibly, that people like the taste of?
Right. They're saying because before 1989, they didn't have to control the levels. So that could be the thing that is the flavoring agent.
Cancer-causing compounds.
Yeah. Oh, well, cool. All right. Okay. So, you know, and nobody really likes to talk about that, kind of like, you know, it's Jennings said basically, like, when he made this comment, like, it's kind of like second to talking about alcoholism within the industry. It's just sort of taboo. Like, we don't talk about that. We don't acknowledge that. So it could be urethane, but if it is, nobody's going to say for sure. But Eddie Russell, who is the current master distiller of Wild Turkey, who took over from his father, Jimmy Russell, said both he and his dad really didn't keep an archive of past products and haven't since Pernod Ricard bought it. He also says that it's really not very different from what they make today.
Okay.
He said the recipe, the yeast, and the process hasn't changed since he started in 1981. But he has admitted that the entry proof has changed over the years. It started as 107, and over the years it's gone to 115, which can make the alcohol taste a little bit more grainy.
Okay.
And Eddie has also explained in his own words, the biggest difference is that back in the 70s and 80s, everybody had excess whiskey because it wasn't too popular. So there was older whiskey in the blends from excess stocks. So basically, now that it's more popular, the listed ages are more accurate. They have to list the youngest age on it.
Right.
Another event that could have contributed is that in 1990, they finally switched from Cypress fermentation tanks to stainless steel. And since wood, cypress wood, is pretty porous and it's harder to clean, there could have been some bacterial influences.
Hmm.
Although, just to play devil's advocate in there, Maker's Mark still uses cypress stills and they don't have the funk.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's still kind of a mystery. We're not really sure, but there's something that makes Wild Turkey that was produced from the 1970s up to like the early 90s taste a little funky.
I'd be curious to try it, except for if it's the urethane
thing. Right, except for if it's the cancer thing. Yeah,
that seems like I don't want to roll that die. Actually, no, I don't want to try it. I don't want to try it.
I mean, a little bit probably won't kill you. There's lots of things can give you cancer.
Well, fair, but.
Whatever the case, like whatever the cause. Dusty Hunters, and that is what they call themselves.
Dusty Hunters. That's a choice you made. Okay. Yep. All right.
Dusty Hunters will search the backs of the off-the-beaten-path liquor marts and scour the dark web and pay top dollar to get that funk, as these vintage bottles have become increasingly rare. A bottle of Wild Turkey 12-year-old gold foil label, nicknamed by Dusty Hunters as Cheesy Gold Foil, will go for around $900 on the internet.
Wow.
Yeah. So some of the most sought after are Wild Turkey Kentucky Legend, which is nicknamed Donut because of the shape. And this was like a weird, like, it was originally made for like a Japanese duty-free product. Like, it wasn't really ever sold in America, and it's kind of shaped like a Crown Royal bottle.
Okay.
Yeah. There's also Wild Turkey Beyond Duplication, Wild Turkey 12-year-old Gold Foil, aka Cheesy Gold Foil. We already talked about that. Wild Turkey 12-year-old, aka Split Label, because apparently that's like something that happens to the label. Is it just splits?
Huh.
Cool. And Wild Turkey Kentucky Spirit, aka Pewter Top. They all have their own distinct flavor profiles, but one thing we know for certain is that these Dusties are funky.
Funky turkey.
Funky turkeys. Seizing the opportunity in the market, Wild Turkey brand ambassador Bruce Russell, who is also Eddie's son, right? So like, when this whole thing started, like in the 70s, it was Jimmy Russell was the master distiller, and then it was Eddie Russell, and now brand ambassador Bruce Russell believes that there's private barrel editions of the current Russell's Reserve single berry that
Singleberry?
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 The Russell's Reserve Single Barrel. Anyway, you know, that can be pretty close to the funky stuff. Yeah.
I've met them. I've met the Russells.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, cool.
I met them at a Wild Turkey training session.
Oh, yeah? Mm-hmm. Cool people?
They were very nice. They were very educational. The remark that I got was, it's so nice to see women in the audience when whiskey's concerned. And I was like, thanks.
Oh, man. Oh,
I mean, it's okay. Fine, but it's like fine, me and like the like other female bartenders I was like, yeah, we've been here for a while, but you're old. It's okay.
Yeah, women love whiskey. I mean, everybody, like, all different kinds of people love whiskey.
It was like, we're happy you're here because we don't usually get your kind. And I'm like, oh, no, what does that mean?
Oh, man.
No, I mean, they were very nice and they're very educational. Just like, you know, they're just a different time. Anyway.
Yeah. Okay, right. Well, now there's the whiskey movement, like, parentheses, her in whiskey, but like, Worski.
Okay. We'll take what we can get.
Yeah, right. We'll take it. So in 2015, they even released a limited edition Wild Turkey called the 1998. It initially sat on the shelves for a while, being like a limited edition reserve whiskey, and like nobody was like trying to get their hands on that shit. And at the time, it had a price tag of like $250. After the internet got the word out and said, hey, that stuff's got the funk, everybody went crazy, and now you can get it on the internet for $750. So, you know, thanks, internet. It's not too out of the ordinary for vintage spirits to be sought after and to be so expensive, but what is unique about Wild Turkey is that most of the vintage whiskeys, or even just like vintage liquors in general, that are on the market that are going to sell for that price range, the distillery isn't making shit anymore. And Wild Turkey is the one that they're still making stuff, but then their old bottles are going for this high price range. And that's what's kind of weird about it. But, you know, have you tried the funk? Let us know.
Yeah. I'm a little dubious about that because I mean, I get it. Like, I see stuff on shelves in liquor stores and bars that is like just so astronomically priced, and if it's something unique, something that's not made anymore, or it's a vintage, it's really cool, it's a single malt situation, I get it to a certain extent. But at some point, it's kind of like someone being like, hey, you like pizza, you want this $300 slice of
right.
pizza? I'm like, but I really like this $1 slice of pizza. This $1 slice of pizza is really heckin' good. Yeah,
right.
So I'm not like, I love bourbon, and there's a certain amount of quality implied with the rules of bourbon.
Yeah.
Like, we'll do that on a different episode. But bourbon kind of comes with a certain staple of, like, it's probably good. And so if you're like, do you like that bourbon? How about the same bourbon, but an extra all this money? I'm like, no!
Right. The idea is that these particular bottles, because they were bottled during that time, have a different flavor, and it's rare. Because Wild Turkey in itself, like, just like what they're producing today, what's like is typically found on like the lower shelf, is
it's like a mid-range
pretty
product.
Good.
Yeah, it's
not bad, it's pretty good. But then these are like, they kind of sat on the shelves for a while. You know, whiskey doesn't really age in the bottle. There's some oxidation that can happen, and that has to do with like corkage. And actually, Wild Turkey is known for sometimes having like a little bit of disintegration on their corks. So, you know, maybe, but it's got to be aged in the barrel, and then you bottle it and it pretty much stays the same. So these are kind of like a time capsule of what they were. In the beginning, when people started talking about this on the internet, they started going to liquor stores and seeing if they had any old bottles, and they bought them out. As people talk about it more, they become more rare and the price goes up. It's crazy, man. $900?
Yeah, I don't think I mean, that's cool. That's cool, though. That's a neat thing that's out there. Whatever.
Yeah, if you want to spend your money that way, cool. Yeah. It's kind of crazy, but gobble.
There you go. You can do a punch. You can do some Wild Turkey. You can bring a funky bottle of Wild Turkey if you really want to drop some money on your fam, I guess.
Yeah, I guess. Or if you just like look in your parents' liquor cabinet, if they started it in the 70s but they're not bourbon drinkers, just like see. I feel like I'm gonna go home and like look in the cabinet and see.
Maybe
you'll find a treasure.
Sell it on the internet.
yeah, so happy Thanksgiving. Thanks to everybody who donated to our Patreon, and thanks to all of our new Patreon members. Makes my heart skip a beat every time I see that somebody signed up. We use that money to pay for the supplies that we need to make those delicious cocktails for you, and in the future, we're trying to get some better recording equipment. It's getting better all the time. If you want to be one of our Patreon supporters, we're going to put that link in our show notes. If you decide to support us, we are asking our supporters on Patreon to send us a booze-related question, and maybe we'll answer it on the podcast. We probably will eventually get to all of them, but it's slow going, so don't worry. Hang tight. Thank you to everybody who tweeted and retweeted about the show. It really helps us get the word out. Tommy Smurl, Michael Beck, Jennifer, Jonathan Gerard, Stephanie Cooperstein, Dorothy Hoover, Jean, Barry, Sydney McElroy, Purple Worm, Moth, Jack Daniels. I don't think it's like the Jack Daniels, but
who knows,
hey, man. Who knows? Who knows? Thanks, man. Ian Blizzard, Emmy, Kyle, M at Kumo Dreaming, Busoris, Austin Wills, and Kat. If I pronounced anyone's name wrong, I'm so, so sorry. It's very stressful for me to think about that each week. Find us on Twitter and Instagram at NeatBoozeCast. Thank you to Absurdist for our wonderful theme music. If you're listening on iTunes, please subscribe and give us a review if you like. And don't forget to head over to our YouTube channel. We're going to have a new video on Tuesday.
We'll see you then. So I've been Taylor Smurl.
And I've been Liz June.
And this has been
Neat.